You're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284AL Haleiwa.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we'll learn about glyphosate's insidious effect on the health of life on Earth from legendary agricultural researcher Dr. Don Huber. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, Kauai Marine and Mower, and 808 Equipment Rental.
In acknowledgement of today, World Food Day, we're honoring a real food hero. Dr. Don Huber, emeritus professor at Purdue University, recently visited Kauai to share his wealth of knowledge on the effects of glyphosate on global food production. Here he is presenting his research at the Seeds of Doubt conference in Los Angeles on October 6, 2012.
We're told in American agriculture or world agriculture that it's impossible for us to produce enough food for another 2 billion people without having genetic engineering. I want to assure you that it's not impossible. We've been doing impossible things for 2,000 or 3,000 years or 10,000 years. We have more food today than we've ever had available for about 7 billion people. We can do it. We have to realize that we're only harvesting 25 to 30% of the genetic potential of our crops now. It's those stresses that are taking away the rest of that genetic potential ability with the limited knowledge and effort that we're putting into it to actually develop the expression of that other 70% of the genetic potential to meet the world's needs. We can do it. We see that those stress factors all have an impact as far as taking away from the nutritional availability for the plant, and we can also use those nutrients then to remediate and to overcome those stresses to capture more of the genetic potential that those plants have in them. Those nutrients are very essential for capturing the sun's energy, for storing it as sugar, and that's the great miracle that we have in plant production or crop production. But in order to do that, it also has to have all of those minerals. You look at magnesium as a component of the chloroplast molecule, as manganese required to split the water for photosynthesis. We have the iron and all of the other nutrients involved in all of those interrelated physiological processes that are required for that crop to really work as hard for us as it wants to work. It requires a balanced nutrition because it's an interdependent, interrelated system where all of those nutrients then work together to get the job done, and so that plant can really provide those nutrients. What we need to recognize is that in farming, we're really managing an ecology. That ecology consists of the plant, the abiotic or the physical environment, a very dynamic biological environment, and then those stresses, the pathogens, the diseases, the insects, those other stresses that come into play to reduce the nutrient availability or efficiency that that plant needs. Anytime we change anything in agriculture, we change the interaction of those four components. There isn't such a thing as a silver bullet where you can just do one thing. We're really doing all of those. We change and affect all four of those components with everything that we do. We use that then to modify our disease pressure, to increase our nutrient availability, our nutrient density in our crops, to improve our overall production efficiency. If we look at the nutrients, we know they're part of the composition, part of the components of the plant, But they're the micronutrients especially are also the regulators, inhibitors, and activators of all of those physiologic processes that let the plant manifest that genetic potential to meet our needs and the needs of our animal. I've depicted it here kind of like a key for an engine. You can have a 400 horsepower engine sitting out there in a truck or in a car or a tractor, do a tremendous amount of work. Doesn't do any work at all for you, though, until you turn the key on. These micronutrients as the cofactor or the catalyst for those enzyme functions are the key. Anytime we want to stop one of those functions, we pull the key out of the ignition. All of our herbicides are what we call chelator. Chelator is onto another one, onto another element, and its solubility, its function, its activity. All of our herbicides are chelators that can immobilize nutrients. That's how they work. Glyphosate's different from all of our other herbicides in that it's a very broad spectrum chelator. Most of our herbicides are very specific for a specific nutrient. Glyphosate chelates any cation. So that even though we say that it inhibits the EPSPS enzyme, it's really a chelator for a lot of other micronutrients besides just manganese, and it shuts down many enzyme systems, phenylalanine ammonialase, indoleacetic acid oxidase, a number of other enzymes besides the EPSPS enzyme. But it's a chelator. It'll chelate in the tank, as you can see here, where we just added a little zinc to the spray tank. We lost our herbicidal activity because glyphosate was already chelated. Could no longer then chelate in the plant. And this is in a Roundup Ready soybean. You see that it's still chelating so that there will be a transient yellowing of the plant after glyphosate's applied because it's tying up those nutrients that are required for photosynthesis. It also chelates in the soil. And that's how it's detoxified. It's not necessarily degraded, but it's chelated with calcium and magnesium and the other cations in the soil so that it's detoxified, but it may be residual for many years. It can be absorbed in the soil. And you can see the two factors here are pH. The lower the pH, the greater the sorption of glyphosate, which makes it less available for microbial degradation, or the higher the content of clay will also increase the sorption of glyphosate into the soil and extend its lifetime. Its half-life may be 60 to 90 days, or it may be 22 plus years. Depends on soil conditions, depends on microbial activity, and other factors. We've been using glyphosate for 30 years. We have situations then where all of a sudden we see dramatic damage from glyphosate that may have been applied over the previous 5 or 6 years, 10 years, that we hadn't anticipated. When we put out our phosphorus fertilizers to get excellent or optimum crop growth, we find that the phosphate in the fertilizer can desorb the phosphite of glyphosate to again make it very active. What you see in this research of BOTS is that it's very broad spectrum chelator. It reduces the availability then and uptake of all of the cations. It's even a competitive inhibitor for phosphate in uptake, an anion. The more glyphosate or the more phosphorus that's applied, the more glyphosate that can be desorbed and then active against the plants. It's also more active against the root system than it is against the top. Root uptake of glyphosate is much more damaging, takes much lower rates. If we look at the rate, this is 1/40th of the herbicide rate, or about a half ounce per acre. You see a reduction of 50% in iron uptake by the root system, 80% reduction in manganese. When we look at the translocation, though, of those micronutrients, you'll see an 80 to 90% reduction in translocation. It's not just the roots that require those micronutrients for physiological function. Extremely powerful compound as far as a chelator and a changer in that physiological function for the plants. We have our thumbs between the bricks. If we look at glyphosate and its mode of action, it's systemic. Powerful herbicide because you just squirt a little bit on the plant and it distributes itself. Accumulates in root tips, shoot tips, reproductive structures, and legume nodules. Those are your active components of the plant, meristematic tissues, where glyphosate accumulates. 80% will stay in the plant for the life of the plant. If you put it out late, where the plant is primarily in a reproductive phase, most of the glyphosate's going to accumulate in the food that you eat. So if it's used as a ripening agent, like it is for wheat and barley or peas, number of other crops, they're not genetically engineered, but it's used to desiccate them, essentially to shut down all the system before harvest. The only active sink or place that glyphosate can go is into the food that you're going to eat yourself or that you're going to feed to your animals. That's how it works. It's systemic because it moves down into the root system, and if it doesn't move into the root system, you won't have any herbicidal effect. But as it moves down, it shuts down that shikimate pathway. It's responsible for the resistance or the defenses of that plant to the soil-borne fungi that are always present. Fusarium, Rhizoctonia, the other fungi that are very serious disease organisms for us and all of our crops are stimulated then by the glyphosate that moves out into the root exudates. You have a plant that has compromised resistance. You've given it a bad case of AIDS. And glyphosate is also an extremely powerful antibiotic. Very broad spectrum for our major groups of organisms, but stimulates soil-borne pathogens against the plant. In your intestine, it stimulates Clostridium, encourages botulism, stimulates Clostridium perfringens also, defecal or diarrhea, Salmonella and E. coli. Those organisms are common in the environment. But you change that ecology, whether it's in your intestine or an animal's intestine and GI tract, or whether it's in the soil, because glyphosate is an extremely powerful antibiotic that we're putting millions of pounds in the environment and then argue about how much streptomycin or how much penicillin or how much tetracycline we might be using and using in agriculture to increase resistance. It's a very powerful antibiotic, toxic to many of those beneficial organisms in the soil that would normally control these soil-borne pathogens. You can see in this work from Dr. Robert Kramer at the University of Missouri, even in Roundup Ready soybeans, you have a 500% increase in root infection by Fusarium, the cause of sudden death syndrome. You also see that reduction in the pseudomonads and other organisms that would provide the natural biological control for that Fusarium. They're very sensitive to it. The manganese-reducing organisms that make manganese available in the soil, very sensitive to glyphosate. Those synergistic organisms that work with the rhizobium and bradyrhizobium to give us nitrogen fixation so we don't have to go out and fertilize and apply nitrogen for our legumes because we can take the free nitrogen from the air. but they're all very sensitive to glyphosate. So we've changed the biology dramatically by taking those beneficial organisms out, stimulating then those organisms that make our nutrients less available. The plant is less efficient. It's more susceptible, has a smaller root system to do the scavenging, and we see those problems then that are becoming manifest throughout our production agriculture to reduce our efficiency and nutritional value. The mode of action of glyphosate is by stimulating the soil-borne pathogens to create super pathogens through the root exudates and to give the plant a bad case of AIDS. You can't kill a plant with glyphosate in sterile soil. Well-established mode of action, very rarely cited. If you look at the 1995 explanation for glyphosate's mode of action, they listed as being an inhibitor of the EPSPS enzyme, parenthesis, herbicidal mode of action unknown. This mode of action was actually documented in 1984. Number of good peer-reviewed scientific papers that document the fact that you increase the susceptibility to these plants that are treated with glyphosate, and it's the pathogens that do the killing. We see it also with our foliar diseases. This with anthracnose. This would be a very severe case of anthracnose on beans. You can see eventually that the plant will wall off that pathogen and you just have a severe lesion. If you take a dilute solution of glyphosate, as Gurry-Yohall did in this situation, put it where those black dots are and then put a spore of the fungus above or below that, you see there's no defense. The plant's defense mechanism has been shut down, and so it's just a matter of time before the fungus is taken advantage of that dinner table and moved across the tissues. These are the mode of action for killing plants with glyphosate as a weed killer. You can see many familiar names there for those of it work in the area. We also have some new diseases that we attributed to just saprophytic activity in the past, but these are Roundup Ready soybean plants. You can see that in the greenhouse and inoculated soil, Corn Ospora can be a fairly good root infecting pathogen, but it's not going to kill the plant. Look at what happens though if you put a little glyphosate on the foliage of those Roundup Ready soybean plants, get that root exudate moving out into the soil where it stimulates the manganese oxidation potential that this fungus uses as a virulence factor. And there I've seen yield reductions of as much as 40%. We see a number of other diseases becoming much more severe. This sudden death syndrome caused by Fusarium. You can see where the farmer didn't want to hook his boom on his power poles. You can go down a half mile through the field. Every one of his power poles has a green bunch of soybeans around it because he moved out and he didn't get his glyphosate applied. But you look at the rest of the field and you see the sudden death syndrome shortening the life of that plant, reducing his yield and also reducing the quality of that crop that's produced. This is a research field at Purdue University. This field's been in the same crop rotation, same tillage, same fertility for 30 years. It's supposed to be a uniform field. What happened this year was that it split right down the middle. Half of it had severe root and crown rot from the take-all fungus. The other half was still very healthy with just a little bit of root nibbling from this common soil-borne pathogen. Didn't make any sense. It was all Roundup Ready soybeans the year before. Again, for 30 years, it had all been treated the same because we want our research plots to all be uniform. We want to be able to control the variables. What we found was that in those Roundup Ready soybean plants, we didn't find it and figure it out until we asked our station superintendent what that red flag meant, because nothing else that was done made any sense. And he thought about it and he said, I had a few weeds showing up in my Roundup Ready soybeans up here. So I sent my crew out and told them, take them out with glyphosate. You're a heretic if you have a weed showing up in the field, especially at an experiment station. So that this side of the field had done a good enough job for the last 10 or 12 years controlling his weeds. Didn't have any need to put the glyphosate out. So that in the last 30 years, the only change on that field was a previous crop of glyphosate the previous year. But you see how it changes that soil biology. You can't do just one thing without changing the interaction of all four of those components. Some research of Dr. Miriam Fernandez, 8-year study in Saskatoon, Canada. We're seeing a massive increase in severity of mycotoxins in our food, deoxynivalenol, fumonisin, and the T2, T1 toxins. So that we're seeing that as a serious problem. It's been growing for us now for almost 30 years. This disease used to be very strictly geographically limited because it requires flowering, it required precipitation, and it required an 80-degree temperature before the plant would become susceptible to the head blight stage, always susceptible to the root rot. What happens with the glyphosate, as Dr. Fernandez has documented, is that you no longer need the 80-degree temperature, because glyphosate changes the physiology of that plant so that it's susceptible all the time. If we're going to use a fungicide on it, it's not just the 2 or 3 days where those three factors came together in the past. Now you have to protect it for at least 5 days before flowering, the 3 days of flowering, and at least 10 days after flowering if you're going to have any benefit from a fungicide, because you've shut down and changed the physiology for resistance. What Dr. Fernandez has shown is that if you've used glyphosate one or more times in the previous 3 years, before you plant your barley or wheat, you're going to increase the severity of head scab and the toxins that it produces. If you use it every year, you can increase the head scab about 300%. If you're following Roundup Ready canola, it goes up even more because your glyphosate rate is higher and you're changing that soil biology. We have a disease we used to consider a very wimpy disease, Goss's wilt on corn. It costs us 1 billion bushel in the Midwest last year. It'll be more this year, but it'll be confused with the drought. Glyphosate eliminates the resistance to this bacterial disease. It's very easily spread. And we're also seeing heavy seed contamination now, which used to be a thing that we just ignored in the past. Our Roundup Ready crops are very susceptible to it. They had to decrease the resistance to Goss's wilt in order to get expression of the Roundup Ready and the BT traits. So they compromised the farmer for the proprietary control. Then they didn't realize that when you put that glyphosate and those strong surfactants out, you also nullify what genetic resistance you have left, because you provide a continuous water film for that bacterium to penetrate the normal openings in the plant, the stomata and the hydatodes, rather than in the past where it had to have severe wounding or a driving rain or a hailstorm. Again, just putting the surfactant on can predispose those plants to Goss's wilt and also Stewart's wilt. What we're seeing is that Goss's wilt now is a very serious epidemic problem for us, not just in eastern Nebraska and western Iowa, where it was limited to for 30 years. It occurs anywhere on North American continent and anywhere that the seed that's grown in the Midwest has been shipped worldwide because of the seed-borne contamination and the increased susceptibility. We've changed the system. But we have genetic engineering so that we shouldn't have to worry about glyphosate. Should all be the same. They're substantially equivalent, supposedly. What you have, though, is that what most people don't realize is that there's nothing in that GMO plant that does anything for the glyphosate that's supplied to it. It's only inserting another EPSPS genetic system, one from the bacteria, soil bacterium, and making it possible for you to treat the plant without killing it directly. Glyphosate, when it's applied, is still a strong chelator for those micronutrients. Your Roundup Ready plants aren't as efficient. They're lower in many of the nutrients that we rely on for our animals and for ourselves. But just putting the gene in disrupts the genetic integrity of the plant, so that, as you can see in these university studies, it's reduced its ability to take up those essential micronutrients even without the glyphosate. Then when we apply the glyphosate, we have an additional impact on the efficiency of those plants to keep those motors running so that we can harvest that genetic potential that the Lord gave us in those plants to meet our needs and to meet the future needs that we have. If we look at Roundup Ready soybeans and just look at the impact of that chelation even on the GMO plants, you can see a reduced lignin content. That's a structural component. You see the reduced photosynthesis through CO2 fixation. This would be the old recommended rate of glyphosate with Roundup resistant weeds. That rate's gone up 3 to 5 times. It's clear out here, off the table, off the scale. We're growing those crops as a nutrient source for us or our animals. Look at the amino acids. And what you see this year especially, or in my area in Idaho, or you'd see here in California, it takes twice as much water to grow a pound of dry matter in a Roundup Ready plant as it does in the non-Roundup Ready. For my neighbors in Idaho, it costs them $100 an acre just for the electricity to pump their water. You're going to double that with the Roundup Ready crop because you've cut the efficiency in half. In the Midwest, under rain-fed conditions, you see that showing up as very severe drought stress. Larry Purcell at the University of Arkansas said when you put glyphosate out pre-plant as a burn down, all of a sudden the plants that are grown after that become much more susceptible to drought. You put the gene in and they become extremely susceptible to drought. So that you see that effect manifest then. I had some pictures earlier that I was going to show and can't show them right now, of just showing you what that looks like in the field this year, because what you're going to hear from the news is that the drought took all of our yield and you as a consumer are going to pay for it because corn's at $8 or a little over $8 a bushel, soybeans at $16 to $17 a bushel. It's you that pays for it. Side by side with just a dirt road or a fence road between a GMO and a non-GMO soybean field or a corn field, and corn, those have been harvested now, have 8 locations around the Midwest. We're running 100 bushel higher yield in the non-GMO under the same drought stress. You have a smaller root system. You have a lower nutrient efficiency. We've compromised that plant. Yeah, drought hurt. But if it hadn't have been for the GMOs, we'd seen soybean prices at about $5, or as projected this spring, $5.38 a bushel rather than $17 or $16, as we're seeing them now. Reduces nitrogen fixation, as you can see here. Just putting the gene in makes that environment and the root system less conducive for that synergistic relationship. And then you put the glyphosate out, and it further reduces the efficiency because you don't have the cobalt that's there to support that plant. You go into our animals and you start analyzing the liver for manganese, for vitamin B12. They're all deficient because there's enough glyphosate in the environment to chelate and to immobilize those two critical essential elements for immune function and detoxification. Study of Belloloy, where he was looking at, wanted to compare low rates drift rates of glyphosate. In this case, he has about a 12.5% of the herbicide rate, 56 grams per acre, not a whole lot of chemical. But he compared two glyphosate susceptible varieties because they wouldn't be killed at that level. It wouldn't shut down the shikimate pathway. And he compared a glyphosate resistant line for comparison. You can see that there's not any difference between them because there's nothing in that genetic technology that does anything to the glyphosate. Just means you can put it on and not kill the plant. But then when you look at the ability of that plant to work for you, and it wants to work just as hard as it can, when you put that gene in and you go into an iron, low iron environment, the plant will actually produce an enzyme, ferric reductase, release it out of the root system that reduces the oxidized iron in the soil to make it available to meet its needs. What you see with the genetically engineered plant is that we've compromised the ability of that plant to work for you. We've put one arm behind its back and said, I still expect you to produce enough food for 9 billion people when I've compromised you so you can only produce enough for 5.
You're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. This is In the Garden on the Farm. And we're listening to Emeritus Professor Dr. Don Huber speak on glyphosate.
That change in nutrition and nutrient value not only affects the production of the plant, but again, those nutrients are what that seed needs to resist the stresses when it's grown again. But it's also what we're eating or feeding to our animals. You can see, again, in Roundup Ready soybeans, 45% reduction in manganese, 49% in iron, 13% in magnesium, 26% in calcium. 6 years ago, I had a veterinarian call me from Northeast Iowa, and he said, what can you tell me about manganese? I told him I could tell him the 26 enzymes that it's required in the plant as a cofactor for, tell him what that soil biological cycle looks like in making it available, and I asked him why a veterinarian's interested in manganese. Said, I thought that you had too much manganese in the rations, and 15 years ago we recommended that it be cut back. The same time we released Roundup Ready soybeans, which provide a major component of the protein supplement in the feed. We started feeding them only half the manganese. He said, in spite of all the drugs that I'm dumping into my cattle and my pig farmers, said, I still have them going out of business. I can't keep them healthy. Said, when I do an analysis, a necropsy on them, and analyze the liver, 100% of them will be deficient in manganese and in B12. Shuts down that system. We don't have the shikimate system in man, but we have a lot of other systems that require those trace elements. You can see if we have a glyphosate, you shut down the start of a pathway, you affect all of the rest of those reactions in that pathway. Go through this very quickly because most people don't recognize the symptoms of glyphosate injury. If you talk to a weed scientist and you ask him, what's it look like when you have glyphosate damage? Most of them will tell you the plant dies if it's not genetically engineered. Again, you can't kill a plant with glyphosate in sterile soil. That's not a symptom of glyphosate. Death is a symptom of increased susceptibility to the pathogens. The primary two symptoms of glyphosate, bud and fruit abortion, because it inhibits the indoleacetic acid pathway, the hormone pathway for the plant. All of these other symptoms, whether it's an abiotic stress or whether it's leaf curling or slow growth or stunting, those are all symptoms of just nutrient deficiency. If we look at a plant that's planted, a wheat plant that's planted a day or two after you've sprayed your broadcast herbicide down with glyphosate, and then look at it 7 or 8 weeks later, you'll still see symptoms of that nutrient deficiency. If you ask an agronomist what these symptoms are, he'll tell you, well, soil was too cold, soil was too dry, it was too wet, there was too much residue on the surface. But if you go to the textbook for nutrient deficiency symptoms, you look at wheat or barley and you see this tip dieback, very classical symptom for copper deficiency. Look at leaf curling. Look at the grain, typical symptom of manganese and zinc deficiency, general chlorosis, nitrogen and iron deficiency. You've got all the symptoms there. Nobody puts the dots together. What happens then when you plant immediately after spraying and applying the glyphosate? Again, glyphosate is detoxified by chelating. Our label says it's safe to apply glyphosate any time before emergence. The Israeli label says that it's not safe for up to 3 weeks. That's because it takes time for it to be chelated and detoxified. In this situation, you can see planting 2 days after the glyphosate, you have a very poor stand, a spindly plant. If you wait 3 weeks or 2 weeks, then you see that the glyphosate's had a chance to be detoxified or to be chelated in the soil so that the plant isn't exposed to it until you apply your phosphorus fertilizer for a later crop and desorb that so that it then comes back to haunt you. We see the effects of manifest more in no-tillage than in the tillage. But look at the long-term effect. And I have growers that consistently say, my crops don't look as good as they used to. They're not as vigorous. It takes longer for them to get established, longer for them to grow. And you look at what happens when that residual glyphosate then is released or the roots come in contact with it. And it doesn't take very much, at 12 grams per acre, to inhibit the nutrient uptake and translocation of those critical elements. Farmer in Idaho, western Idaho, we pride ourselves in the size of our onions. That's a major crop. Consider Parma the onion capital of the country. Had a farmer that followed the label. He planted his onions in the morning, came out, sprayed his glyphosate, got halfway across the field and the sprayer broke. Went back to the shop and figured, well, I'll get it fixed, get back out there in the morning. We had 3 days of sprinkle and he didn't get out. He was afraid that those shallow planted plants would germinate. This side never got the glyphosate, never got the weed control. 6 weeks later, you can still see that gray-green manganese and zinc deficiency. Compare that where he didn't have his glyphosate, that bright green. Not quite a 50% reduction in mass, but an 80% reduction in marketable bulbs. You can't get bulking. We see the same thing with potatoes. With potatoes, you'll see that normally we would have 35 to 40% of the potatoes that would be those beautiful Idaho Bakers, 10 or 12 ounces. You see that in some situations they're down to 5%. That's a tremendous economic cost to the farmer, just like on the onion. What we found in here was that all of these farmers use essentially the same fertility program. They're in the same county, same soil type, same weather. But the difference was whether they had applied glyphosate in the previous 2 years. If they hadn't, they were still doing like they'd done for 30 years. Still 35 to 40% over that 10-ounce size. If that applied one or two applications of glyphosate as a burn down, just a blanket application sometime before planting the potatoes, they cut it in half. If they followed Roundup Ready corn, all of these had corn. I started out with 50 growers. I took all of them out that had something besides corn in the rotation. All of them had corn. The difference here was the Roundup Ready corn changes the soil microflora to make manganese less available and also then has a higher rate of glyphosate going out to have a tremendous economic impact. We've lost the benefit of much of our crop rotation for disease control because glyphosate changes that soil biology to eliminate entire groups of organisms that we rely on to give us natural biological control for these soil-borne pathogens that we don't have good resistance or even chemicals for. And so we see an increase in many other diseases, especially those diseases like the Fusarium and the Rhizoctonia, or the Phytophthora diseases, because glyphosate stimulates their virulence mechanism. We've not only created super weeds, we've created super pathogens and changed the biology so that our pathogens have a free rein then in that activity. Not just those on the plants, but also those that affect our intestinal microflora and protect our crops from Salmonella and E. coli on the leaf surfaces. They're no longer there. The pathogens have always been there. We didn't worry about them as long as we had that natural biological control. Why do you think we had to recall 20% of our egg production in this country 2 years ago? Because of Salmonella. Newspaper report said it's because we found chicken manure there and we found rat droppings. Now, my children have had chickens as a project for I don't know how long in their 4-H program. I don't know that you can have a chicken without chicken manure. I don't know that you can have feed around even with some really good cats without having a few rodents. That's not the problem. We changed the flora, the microflora. We no longer have those pseudomonads and bacillus and a lot of those organisms that would contain those pathogens. We don't have them in our intestine. We don't have them as a protection on our crops, as Sivathas Hamparan and his group in Australia have shown. To keep us in business, there are some things we can do, but you have to recognize that powerful impact of both the GMO process and the glyphosate that those plants are engineered to tolerate, the powerful impact that they have on nutrition. Part of that impact is also through the biological balance, and there are things that we have to do. We've got to get our biological balance back. That's why we're seeing such a big response in probiotics for our animals and also for people. We used to didn't see that dynamic and effect. We also see it in our soils. We have to add the leguminoculants that for years have become established in the soil because they're no longer there. We need to start having a much more judicious use and look for alternatives to this very potent entity. And I'd like to move through some of that remediation and get to some of the other areas in the food and feed safety concerns. So that we're seeing, as I indicated, increased levels of the mycotoxin. All of your fusaria are increased and stimulated by glyphosate. And Dr. Miriam Fernandez was going to report on her research on the interactions of glyphosate and the head scab fungus that produces many of those toxins. She got a call the night before and was told that if she did, she'd be sitting in a courtroom threatened with a lawsuit. She asked me what to do. I said, well, you've known me for a few years. If it was me, I'd really embellish it to the nth degree. She said, yeah, but you're closer to retirement than I am. She came into the room and was afraid to say boo. She looked around to see if she could recognize any of the representatives, was afraid to even talk about her research because of that threat. I told her she needed to call her supervisor that night. She got him out of bed, said, will you defend me? I've had this threat against me. He said, certainly we'll defend you. You're a government scientist. Your science is very sound. But what you have to remember is that they'll drag you through the mud in a personal character assassination to the point that your career is going to be dead. It may take 4 or 5 years in the courtroom. And the intimidation factor works for many. How difficult it is to even publish a paper. When we had the International Symposium on Glyphosate, we wanted to publish the paper in one of the U.S. journals because several of us are members and have been members, almost lifetime members, of those professions that sponsored the journals. We were turned down on every one of them. We got a good journal, very reputable journal that actually has every bit or a little better rating than some of our U.S. ones. And that was the European Journal of Agronomy. Was willing to publish the tremendous amount of science that was presented at that symposium, international symposium. We couldn't do it in this country. There's a lot of data, again, increasing health risks from the mycotoxins. We have mycotoxin levels this year, compounded the fungal infection, compounded by the drought. They can't even dilute it out and feed it to animals. It's just going to be burned. That's not going to feed a growing world population. That's new. That's not normal. And 30 years ago, that would have been unique. It's common now, and our young scientists think that it is normal. We see the growing nutrient deficiency. Less nutrient density in our crops and our food supply. We see the gene flow, which Jeffrey mentioned, not just to weeds, but also to soil microorganisms from decomposing corn stalks, decomposing soybean residue. We have an embargo on any exported corn from the United States by two countries. If that corn was grown on soil that grew one of five hybrids 10 years ago, those two countries state we will not accept any corn from it because the soil microorganisms can pick up those genes, transfer it over to the new corn crop, and they then produce the toxins. Very serious toxins, very toxic to mammals. We see the direct toxicity of residual glyphosate. Dr. Antonio will present a lot of that interaction. But I'd like to share with you some of the interactions from an agricultural standpoint. Roundup Ready alfalfa, third lower in manganese, only half as much iron. What are those animals, how are they going to respond to disease and infection? Jeffrey Sheffers, veterinarian at the University of Minnesota, reported on his five-year study, studying stillbirths in calves and also deformities. You get a deformed lower jaw. You also have a very knobby, jointed, arthritic type of a skeleton on this calf. 100% of his animals deficient in manganese. You have to have manganese to move calcium into the bone structure. What he also found was that 60% or 63% of those that appeared normal were also deficient in manganese. And then he analyzed the feed. And you see a tremendous range. You take the highest levels here, and those would be more normal just in the sufficiency range. We should have some going way above it. But look at all of these down in this range. You wonder how the plant even survived because it's too low for any kind of efficient photosynthesis. 2002, the United Stock Growers testified before the Senate Ag Committee of two conditions that were threatening the survival of the industry. One of them was premature aging. You'd take a 18 or 24-month animal to the market, and it'd be graded down as though it was a 16-year-old cow just been culled out of the herd. The other one was reproductive failure affecting up to 40 or 50% of the herd that couldn't become pregnant. Said the validity or the viability of the industry is threatened. This is a study 4 years ago in Iowa comparing GMO, non-GMO, premature aging. You see that coloring of the fat in the stomach lining. This is what it should look like. Downgraded as an old cold cow. Not bringing that premium that 18 or 24-month-old prime beef should bring. It's a study 3 years ago in Iowa with pigs. Pig stomach's supposed to look about like ours. Many of you will know that better than I do. I can show you what the outside looks like. Can't show you what the inside does, but this is a normal stomach. Look at the irritation, the allergy response. What do we do with our children if they can't tolerate breast milk or cow's milk? We put them on soybeans. The veterinarians that were doing this study wanted to analyze and get the quantitative data for the intestines because the intestinal lining is deteriorating. You have leaky gut syndrome. These are isogenic lines. The only difference is the genetic engineering. You see that effect. Study that has also been done with rats shows the behavioral changes. Very similar to what you'd see with autism or with attention deficit syndrome. Had a cattleman in Nebraska say that his cows just don't respond the way they used to. They don't have the herd instinct. They want to be alone. They want to go off. They're irritable. Pigs are very irritable. They fight each other. They bite and create some problems. This is what the data looks like as far as inflammatory bowel disease. You see that 42% increase just since 1992. There's always a 4 to 6 year lag phase in that area, but you see the correlation. You look at celiac disease in Alberta's Children's Hospital, and you say, my word, what's happening? What's changed? And if you plot that, this is where Roundup Ready canola was introduced. This is follows almost the exact pattern for the adoption of Roundup Ready canola in Alberta. We can also take about 40 other diseases and look at the epidemiological data and the increase in severity of those diseases, especially the gut disease in our own human population, especially in our children, and see it track. Gilbert Hostetler's a corn breeder, seedsman, had these are isogenic lines. had some normal corn and some triple stack that got set back in the warehouse. Mice cleaned up all of the normal, left all of the triple stack untouched. These are 2 ears, again, of isogenics, sat up in the tree for 9 months for the squirrels. And you see, the squirrels could discriminate, and as Gilbert said, maybe the mice know something that I ought to know. Dr. Monica Kruger, working on chronic botulism, which is an epidemic in many parts of Europe as well as in the U.S., finds that glyphosate, that very potent antibiotic at a tenth of a part per million, can change the microflora in the intestine, the rumen, so that you no longer have that natural biological control, but you end up with the bleeding rumen and stimulation of the clostridium and production of the bot neurotoxin. Again, the direct toxicity, I think, will be addressed by Dr. Antonio. The report from the physicians in Argentina studying drift effects of glyphosate from the Roundup Ready crops in the near vicinity of the villages, 447% increase in birth defects. We look at the effect when you interrupt the endocrine hormone system and how it looks in the different species. We see that very common now. Again, increased miscarriages. You look at the correlations that we have with those target tissues affecting cancer, and then reflect on the recent publication of Dr. Cirillini. The other thing that those cattlemen were reporting was reproductive failure. Cattle that couldn't conceive, and also cattle that were losing their pregnancies, as these two veterinarians in the November Hordes Dairymen reported, said, we can't figure out what's going on, but certainly 20% loss of pregnancy isn't going to keep a dairy in business. And yet they're reporting 27, 25, and again, I know of one dairy that had 70% loss of confirmed pregnancies. 2002, this entity was identified, as Jeffrey indicated, as the cause of both infertility and premature loss of the pregnancy. It's been cultured, very slow growing, grows very well with other organisms, but we know that it affects cattle, horses, sheep, chickens, and humans. And it's very small, it's filterable, again, culturable, has high temperature tolerance, but it affects a broad scope, very unusual scope of people, and it also is associated where we have new symptoms in our plants. The sudden death syndrome are to Goss's wilt extended symptoms. They're a different symptom, and that's where we find this entity. This entity is found in GMO crops or in crops that have been treated with glyphosate for premature ripening. It's a correlation. The association that we see, we know that glyphosate affects or predisposes plants to disease. We know that it also affects animals' resistance, predisposes them to disease. It affects the pathogens by increasing the virulence of those pathogens to give us this extended symptom. And it also changes the environment that we might normally have to control such an entity. Feel that we're in this position because we failed to honor the scientific principle. And as Goss said in one of his poems some years ago, that when understanding ceases, we have a new word to take its place. when we didn't understand all of the ramifications and all of the things that happened with genetic engineering, we just said, must be substantially equivalent. It has roots and a stem and some leaves. The emerging consequences are new diseases. We have emerging diseases. And we've compromised much of the health system for our entire population. I think that future historians may well look back upon our time and not write about how many pounds of pesticide we did or didn't apply, but about how willing we are to sacrifice our children and jeopardize future generations with this massive experiment that we call genetic engineering that's based on false promises and flawed science just to benefit the bottom line of a commercial enterprise. I appreciate the opportunity to participate here with you.
That was Dr. Don Huber presenting at the Seeds of Doubt conference in October last year. And this has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Paul and Robin. Please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life.